crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a statement, the court announced that it has decided by majority that its territorial jurisdiction in the situation in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The ICC's decision has been praised by Palestinians, with Prime Minister Mohammad Shatayeh calling it a victory for justice.
The resolution is a message to the perpetrators of crimes that their crimes will not be subject to statutes of limitations and that they will not go unpunished.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also called the ruling a historic day for the principle of accountability, and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged the court to investigate the Israeli crimes, describing its decision as a major development. Different international human rights organizations have also reacted, with Amnesty International calling the decision a long overdue step towards justice for victims. Human Rights Watch also described the ruling as a real hope for victims of serious crimes. Israel, which is not even a member of the ICC, decried the ruling, saying the court is a political body, not a judicial institution. As expected, the U.S. officially opposed the court's decision. Experts say the ruling is a game-changer for Tel Aviv and Washington.
Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, President Biden will face an interesting challenge. I expect that his reaction will be considerably different than Trump's.
The ruling came amid Palestine's call for further scrutiny into the 2014 Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, in which more than 2,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of children, were killed. 6 years ago, the office of the court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, began a preliminary investigation of Israeli actions in Gaza. In 2019, Bensouda announced that there was a reasonable basis for opening an investigation into the Gaza war and the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Ironically, Israel has continued its crimes against the Palestinians and its expansionist agenda, including illegal settlement activities with the tacit support of the United States and in defiance of UN resolutions. International rights groups have long raised the alarm about Israeli atrocities. Last year, the UN also said that Tel Aviv's excessive force against Palestinians holding weekly anti-occupation rallies may amount to war crimes. The latest ICC ruling has dealt a severe blow to Israel, but will the Palestinians get the justice for crimes they have endured for decades remains to be open.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, international lawyer at the ICC, John Philpott, joins us from Montreal. Also from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier joins us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both, and let me first start with you, if I may, John Philpott, and ask you about this ruling by the ICC. So, looking at how this has come 6 years after it began, in terms of the investigation itself, of illegal Israeli actions in the occupied territories, which included the 50-day Gaza war, not to take away from the importance of the ruling, but rather, first question is, why did it take this long, and does the timing have anything to do with it?
Well, it's taken a long time, and I know that I've personally interviewed a member of Mrs. Bensouda's team in 2012 about this, because I work at the ICC, or I have worked at the ICC. So it's taken a long time. I think you have to give a lot of credit to the Palestinian litigators, the government, the Al-Haq organization, and other jurists who worked on this case to get to this point. And I can, if you like, either now or later, address some of the problems they will face in this. It's a big success, and now the problems will continue, and we'll have to figure out, all of us will have to figure out ways to make it stick, make it work, and obtain justice.
Okay, well, I think that's the whole question of this debate, and I'm going to ask you straight up. I was going to ask this at the end of the debate, but I'm going to ask you now, Mick Napier, as our guest there said, will it stick?
It's impossible to tell.
This is from Mick Napier. I'm sorry, John Philpott, I'll come back to you. Mick Napier, go ahead.
Our friend has expertise that I lack, but I would imagine it's impossible to predict the outcome. The only country I know, I could be corrected, which was ever convicted at an international court of terrorism was the USA in 1986 at the International Court of Justice against Nicaragua, organizing the killing of all sorts of health workers and teachers and so on through the Contras. Nothing happened. It didn't do any good. But the, nonetheless, people around the world are going to watch Israel being taken in front of a tribunal, and the words Israel and criminal court will be fused, will go together in the minds of millions of people. One could ask, why is it taking so long? I mean, not only is Israel peppered with crime scenes of atrocious massacres, it's possible to argue that Israel is a crime scene, given what they have done to the Palestinian people. But I think it's extremely good news. I think it's like the Israeli human rights group recently, saying that Israel is an apartheid state based on Jewish supremacy from the river to the sea. These are acknowledgements of something which is manifestly clear and obvious to everyone, but nonetheless it's welcome that the ICC has recognized what popular opinion around the world has long since concluded, that what Israel's doing to the Palestinians is absolutely atrocious. So I think it will open doors for those of us who are campaigning in countries for the BDS movement, because the words Israel and criminal court will be in the minds of people before we knock on doors. So I suspect this will provide a green light. It will lead to the BDS movement reaching to a higher level.
Well, John Philpott, you mentioned Mohammed Shataya, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority. His reaction to this was, quote, "The resolution is a message to the perpetrators of the crimes that their crimes will not be subject to a statute of limitations and that they will not go unpunished." Now, I'll ask you, when has Israel been punished for anything? If anything, it has been rewarded, especially by the previous U.S. President, Donald Trump.
We have to remember that Democratic and Republican leaders of the U.S. have been very supportive of Israel on almost every level. The Obama administration made a small positive contribution in December 2016 concerning the occupied territories, but the U.S. has never been a friend of the Palestinians, in my opinion, even with the Oslo Accords, which in my opinion, were a form of creating the present apartheid. The legal issues are quite complicated in terms of getting this court to function and getting the prosecutor to function. The Gaza crimes in 2014, which we all saw on television and demonstrated against, Israel has an escape route by saying we're going to have internal courts which are going to investigate that. Obviously, that's a sham and must be unmasked. The same applies to the crimes committed in May 2018 with the Gaza occupants trying to return to Israel. Now I'm speaking about my own impression, and remember, this is hot off the press. I think the war crime of the settlement in the occupied territories is where Israel is particularly vulnerable because it's government policy. And many of us in BDS and in different organizations are campaigning against the colonies. I've been in Palestine a year ago, and I'm not an expert on Palestine as such. And I saw the colonies, and I saw that this is a very long-term sore spot colonization of territories occupied contrary to the Geneva Convention. And I think this is a very vulnerable point for Israel and relatively, how can I say, manageable for the prosecution if the prosecution acts in good faith. Mrs. Bensouda is leaving in a few months, and let's hope her successor follows on this approach. We have to remember what the ICC is, because we, like Iran, like many of us, we are aware of colonialism and imperialism and how it functions. The ICC has been a white supremacist colonial court, very selective in its prosecution, and it's not for the African Union in 2017 asked Africans to withdraw from the court because they've been unfairly selected. Burundi did it. South Africa almost did it. So there's serious risks with the bureaucracy of the ICC. Mm-hmm. I've worked there. Israel, however, is on the defensive. And there's another risk, which, remember in 2009 with the report about war crimes, they also can point at the Hamas, saying that the resistance committed crimes. And this is obviously a red herring and an unfair situation, but we must be very wary of that, and the movement must be very aware of that.
Looking at...
as I said...
Well,
go ahead.
First of all, I'm intrigued by a couple things that you have said there. At the heart of it, I guess, and let me ask McNapier this, is that our guest John Philpott says, at least the impression I got, that the settlements, which is illegal, and it's enshrined in the law, international law, in which all entities, whether it's the European Union, whether it's the U.S. itself, does acknowledge that it's something that has to stop, but it has not gone beyond words. It seemed like our guest there, John Philpott, gave more weight to that, even though in the same context a little bit earlier, he mentioned about how Palestinians were killed in the Gaza War. I mean, it's pretty obvious. But it seemed like the settlements were given more weight. I think that's McNapier maybe somewhat irrelevant in the bigger picture, where the both crimes that were committed, of course, the deaths of Palestinians, is more graphic, more grotesque in a sense. What conclusion can we draw from, for example, the way that the ICC is going to go about this? I mean, do you see anything solid in what they have presented so far?
I think we have to remember that not only has Israel not been penalized for its crimes over many decades, but just to take two examples, Israel was admitted to the United Nations on the condition that it allowed the refugee population which it had created, it allowed it to return if they wanted to live in peace in their homes. That was completely violated, ignored, and just thrown to one side. My own government still subscribes to the right of Palestinian refugees, to that old resolution, formally subscribes to the right of the refugees to return. How could they actively oppose it? But they arm the same forces. They sell sniper rifle parts to the same army, which is killing refugees who demonstrate in Gaza for their right to return. So it's not just perfidious Albion. It's not just that when you shake hands with a British diplomat, you have to count your fingers afterwards. All the chancelleries of Europe will be most of them will be a little bit alarmed at this. But they'll be taking steps to try to minimize the damage. At the end of the day, the question is, will Israel carry on with its long-term policy of just treating world opinion with contempt as long as the air bridge from Washington of weapons and dollars continues? Or might we reach a moment, which reached with apartheid South Africa, where despite the best efforts of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher condemning Mandela as a terrorist and so on, it just reached the stage where apartheid's supporters could no longer support it, could no longer defend it against an enraged world opinion, where black states were boycotting the Olympics, and it really became a massive world issue. There was a semi-insurrection in countries like New Zealand when the South African rugby team went there. It was almost an uprising. So the question is, will an inflamed world opinion see the decision of the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel as a good thing? I think yes. I think this will add to something that's already happening, which is that Israel always crosses a red line. Israel always defies any vestige of international law. As our friend pointed out, the body of law that was developed after 1945 was developed precisely to stop the kind of things that Israel is doing, moving an external population into a conquered area. So yes, it's vulnerable legally, but you know what? The law so often turns out to allow the bad guy to win on a technicality, and the thirst for justice to be thwarted. But I think it's a fantastic step. It's a really good step, but only if people use it in order to build up support for justice for the Palestinians.
I'm going to ask you a question here, John Philpott. I'm not too sure if you may have an answer for this or not, but I'm going to shoot for it anyways. I'm looking at your title, International Lawyer of the ICC, and I'm looking at the fact that the ICC is considering some of the Israeli actions to be war crimes, pointing to what the ICC described as Israel's disproportionate use of force, for example, in the 2014 war in Gaza. If you agree that war crimes were committed, in the capacity that you have, how would you pursue this in order for there to be, at the end of this explanation, for there to be criminal accountability? And where would you experience roadblocks in your pursuit?
All right. So put me in as the prosecutor, all right, which I'm not. I'm a defense lawyer. If I was the prosecutor, I would inform Israel that we as the prosecutor, intend to investigate war crimes, for example, in the war of 2014. Israel has 30 days. Israel can reply to this and say, we're going to have an internal investigation. Then the tribunal would have to verify if Israel's able to have an internal investigation and punish its own leaders seriously, or if it's incapable of doing so. That is, and I would say that Israel obviously cannot do this, but the judges may or may not go against what I am saying. And you will recall that in Britain, with its war crimes in Iraq, was not charged because the court held that it could investigate its own persons, its own criminals who committed crimes in the horrible war in Iraq, but they didn't punish anybody. So that is one of the roadblocks. Similarly, in 2018, but I'm not being defeatist when I say this. I'm saying it's very important to collect the information by the best means possible. There must be a lot of witnesses outside Israel now who can prove the chain of command, because they're more interested in the higher ranking officers. This is why I suggested that the illegal settlements as a war crime is easier to prosecute. I didn't mean it's not as the other ones weren't as serious. They're obviously of grave.
I do apologize
very
for that.
Serious, the murders. Yeah, but no, there's no problem. We're talking, right? But investigating the settlement is easier because it's the government policy. So anyway, that's my take 3 days after the judgment.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Since we're running out of time here, I'm sorry to jump in there. My final question has to go to you, Mick Knapp, here. There are institutions inside the U.S. Under the guise of charity that are funneling money. I shouldn't use the word funneling, that are contributing money to causes that go to settlements. It has been documented, and I'm sure you're well aware of that. So as a guest there said, if settlements is where we can get Israel, settlements are ongoing. Announcements are made quite often. So what can be done in order to have Israel be held accountable and not for that not to continue? I'm guessing the answer lies with the U.S. in part.
Well, let's agitate as widely as possible, push campaign lobby, that there's pressure for a conviction. The ICC's opened an investigation, but you know, many investigations have already taken place. After 2009, there was a UN investigation, alleged Israel was committing war crimes and probable crimes against humanity. Time after time, investigations have led to the same conclusion. Every human rights organization that looks at the situation concludes that Israel is committing grotesque war crimes. But, you know, I remember that Richard Fault, on behalf of the United Nations, I think it was in 2017, published on behalf of a major UN body for West Asia, the conclusion that Israel was an apartheid state. Guterres responded to Nikki Haley ranting at the UN and moved to successfully to suppress that report. In my own country, Britain admits to expelling every human being from the island of Diego Garcia. Ethnic cleansing in our lifetime, they did it. Uh-huh. And the people from there have gone to the Supreme Court in Britain and won, but the British government just ignores it. So I think these legal victories are very important, but only if they act as a stimulus to people around the world.
Very well, thank you. I'm sorry, we're just fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, international lawyer at the ICC, John Philpott. It was a pleasure to have you from Montreal and from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you so much. Mick Napier from Edinburgh. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mika Witawa, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And they worship besides Allah that for which He has not sent down authority, and that of which they have no knowledge. And there will not be for the wrongdoers any helper.
Dear brothers and sisters, we're talking about the 71st verse of the chapter. وَيَعْبُدُونَ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ مَا لَمْ يُنَزِّلْ بِهِ سُلْطَانًا وَمَا لَيْسَ لَهُمْ بِهِ عِلْمٌ وَمَا لِلظَّالِمِينَ مِن نَصِيرٍ. And they worship besides Allah things for which He has sent no authority, and of which they have no knowledge, and for the unjust, there shall be no helper. Concerning the verse, we said that the one who has no clear reason for his belief, the one whose deeds are not based on some fact, actually he is unjust. And he's not only unjust to himself, but he's also unjust to the others. Because it is possible that some others follow him, and they might be also led astray because of his beliefs, because of his deeds, which were based on not a strong belief. So the reason we should worship, the incentive for worshiping the Almighty Allah, might be out of three things. At first, what the Almighty Allah has sent authority. وَيَعْبُدُونَ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ مَا لَمْ يُنَزِّلْ بِهِ سُلْطَانًا. And they worship besides Allah things for which He has sent no authority. So, the first reason we can start worshipping the Almighty Allah or have some of our deeds is the things that the Almighty Allah has sent some authorities. The Almighty Allah has some commandments and some orders, and to follow them will make some of our deeds. Also, the verse continues, وَمَا لَيْسَ لَهُمْ بِهِ عِلْمٍ, and of which they have no knowledge. The second thing which we can follow and have our deeds based on is the guidance of our minds. It's the knowledge, it's the true knowledge of our minds. And the third one is that we might do our deeds just to get help from the Almighty Allah, and just to be hopeful that this will be what the Almighty Allah desires. But the polytheists do not have any of these three things.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
That's why the verse says, وَمَا لِظْلَالِمِينَ مِنْ نَصِيرٍ. Those mushrikeen, those polytheists, do not have any of these three things, and that's why they are called ظَالِمِينَ, the unjust. So if you want to have nasir on the Day of Judgment, you shall have one of these things, Sultan, or the true reason from the Almighty Allah, the commandment, the order of your Lord. The second, Ilm, or the true knowledge, or to be sure that something is true and is based on what the Almighty Allah has ordered. And the third one, which is not actually mentioned explicitly in this verse, is to have our deeds based on something which we feel that it is true, and we actually rely on the Almighty Allah to guide us. But the one who has no clear reason and has no clear actually proof for his belief or deeds is actually unjust, and this is what the verse is trying to tell us. Regarding polytheism, Jabir, may Allah be pleased with him, said, once a man came to the Messenger of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and said, O the Messenger of Allah, what are the deeds which cause a man to enter paradise or hell? In answer to this question, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, whoever from among my ummah dies and has not associated anything with Allah will enter paradise. And whoever dies while he has been associating things with Allah will enter hell. By having the first glance at this tradition, we might feel that we are not among the polytheists. Of course, may the Almighty Allah be pleased with us, and may He keep us away from being polytheists. But we must be really careful with our deeds, since it might be that doing one of our actions, having one of our deeds for someone other than the Almighty Allah, might be having actually a level of polytheism in it. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam has said, you should know that even the smallest hypocrisy is like believing in more than one God, and keeping company of people who follow their low desires is the key to obliviousness from religion, and it is the seat of Satan. May the Almighty Allah keep us away from being the polytheists. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبری.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Around the World with Reporters.
After Coviron vaccine made headlines as the first viable Iranian-made vaccine for the coronavirus, another vaccine now grabs the spotlight, Covpars. Developed by Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute, Covpars is a protein-based vaccine. It employs recombinant versions of the spike protein, which tutors the immune system against the virus. This works with an adjuvant, a compound that puts frontline immune cells on battle alert. to muster a robust immune response to the protein antigen.
This new vaccine works based on a recombinant spike protein. It's a proven method that has been around since 1980 and has been successfully tested on other diseases such as hepatitis. The first Iranian COVID vaccine used inactivated coronavirus, but this one works differently and can be injected or inhaled.
COVPARS is administered in three stages, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and an intranasal administration 30 days after the second jab. Developers say not only does this protect the recipient from the virus, but it prevents them from transmitting the virus to others. Simply put, those who receive the COVPARS vaccine will not need a mask.
The first two doses give protection against the virus and strengthen the immune system against the coronavirus. The third dose, which is administered intranasally, will block the virus from entering the upper parts of the respiratory system. Therefore, the recipient will not exhale the virus and those around them will be safe.
The first phase of the human trial for COVPARS will start next week on 130 volunteers. Developers say the entire human trial stage will take 5 months. Its domestic rival, Coviran, is ahead in schedule and will start the second phase of the human trial next month. At the same time, Iran has imported the first batch of Russia's Sputnik V and will kickstart its mass vaccination this week.
With COVPARS making its way to the human trial stage, Coviran now has a tough rival on its way toward the market. For now, Iran is a few months away from a marketable local vaccine. And until then, officials say Russia's Sputnik V will dominate Iran's inoculation program. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has held a national exhibition to showcase its latest scientific and technological achievements on the occasion of the 42nd victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. In this exhibition, 160 projects on such fields as healthcare, agriculture, defense, electronics, oil, and nanomaterials were unveiled. 90% of the proposed projects have reached production phase.
We process chitosan, which is a sugar that is obtained from the hard outer skeleton of shellfish like shrimp. Our company has processed chitosan at three grades which can be commercialized. Chitosan can be used in different fields like medicine, agriculture, textiles, and cosmetics, and etc. This will save the country hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Manufactured portable GPU or ground power unit, which is used to start the engines of light aircraft and helicopters. If you fully charge it one time, our GPU is capable of starting engines 9 times. This GPU can be used for devices which need high voltage.
Iran is a leading country in the region in terms of global innovation. According to the Global Innovation Index 2020 report, Iran ranks 26th worldwide for the share of its high-tech industries in the national production, surpassing the regional countries such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey.
At this exhibition, we are witnessing the emergence of new talents in our society. As you know, the enemies are trying to impose different forms of sanctions on our nation, but we have cut off the hands of dependence. We believe that sanction was one of the great historic opportunities for the Iranian nation throughout history. We have always stood on our own feet, and today the Iranian youth are moving the country on the path of independence.
According to the Scopus International Citation Database, the rate of scientific contributions of Iranian researchers to the world increased from 17% in 2011 to 31% in 2020, becoming the world's leading country in science diplomacy, with 14% growth.
In the past 42 years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in many fields, including science and technology. And now it has become one of the leading countries in scientific achievements in the world. Sama Kujuri, Tehran.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the country will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only if the United States lifts all its sanctions first. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, is the name of the nuclear deal Iran clinched in 2015 with world powers, including the US. But America withdrew from the accord under former President Donald Trump and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. Now, the new president, Joe Biden, says the US will return to the deal, but Iran must first return to full compliance. Iran rejects this, arguing that it was the U.S. that exited the accord and breached its commitments. Ayatollah Khamenei says it is the definitive and irreversible policy of Iran that the U.S. should first lift its sanctions. The leader also says that it's Iran that has the right to set conditions on the nuclear deal, as it has fulfilled all its commitments under the agreement. The leader's comments follow calls by some Western countries to renegotiate the Iran deal and expand it beyond its nuclear program.
But I do believe that we do need to finalize indeed a new negotiation with Iran, and President Biden has a critical role. We have to address as well the ballistic missiles issues, and we have to address the stability of the region, and this comprehensive agenda is to be negotiated now.
Iran has time and again stressed that the JCPOA is non-negotiable. The country rolled back some of its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after the U.S. pullout. Iran did so after the European countries in the JCPOA, namely France, Britain and Germany, failed to make up for the U.S. withdrawal. Tehran has repeatedly said its rolling back measures are fully reversible once other parties fulfill their commitments. Iran says the ball is now in U.S. court. It says President Biden should now decide on whether to continue the policies of his predecessor or choose a new path. Those policies by Trump under his so-called maximum pressure campaign have already been described as a failure even by some of Washington's closest allies.
Afghanistan received the first consignment of COVID-19 vaccines from India under India's commitments to support the country and health sector. As officials say, the first shipment of the vaccine would be sufficient for only 3% of Afghan population. This comes as Afghanistan is still struggling with the COVID-19 amid shortage of medical equipment.
India have been a great a partner for health sector of Afghanistan in the past years, and this time this is the first country who is came out in the first line and support the health sector of Afghanistan by donation of 500,000 vaccines. For sure, these vaccines will be used for the health workforce, which are the first line people against war for the war against COVID-19 virus in the country.
Afghanistan has already received different shipments and aid from China, Iran and the US to fight the pandemic in 2020. As officials in Kabul say, those at greater risk will be the first recipients of these vaccines. But many have doubted such claims, saying the widespread mismanagement of the first wave of COVID-19 in Afghanistan has tarnished the image of responsible bodies, such as the Ministry of Public Health and some other bodies.
We expect the government to really vaccinate our brave security and defense forces, plus those who are involved in fight against COVID-19 first in accordance to the latest decree of the president. There must be no mismanagement this time.
The World Bank has allocated $100 million and the Asian Development Bank has granted $50 million to provide Afghanistan with the COVID-19 vaccine. Meanwhile, Iran and China are among those countries that have so far assisted the Afghan government in its fight against the pandemic and the different collaborative attempts.
Based on official figures released by Afghanistan's Public Health Ministry, over 50,000 individuals have been infected with COVID-19 so far. Nearly 2,500 of them have died of the disease. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Palestinian leadership has praised the International Criminal Court for its ruling that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories, allowing its chief prosecutor, Fatou Ben Souda, to investigate Israeli atrocities, despite fierce objections from Tel Aviv. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Ishtayi said the decision is a victory for justice, humanity, and freedom, and for the blood of the victims, namely the Palestinians and their families. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also praised the ruling and said it's ready to cooperate with the ICC's prosecutor if an investigation is launched.
We urge the International Court and its chief prosecutor to immediately launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes against the Palestinian people. We have already filed several legal complaints against Israel with the ICC. We are now ready to carry out every possible effort to see Israeli military officials and settlers being prosecuted for their crimes.
The ICC's ruling, however, has angered the Israeli regime, as its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed the ruling as a political tribunal, accusing the ICC for being a political body and not a legal institution. Israel has not joined the International Criminal Court, but the Palestinian Authority is a signatory since 2015. This means the ICC's mandate is to prosecute people, not countries, including those from states that are not signatories, and in this case, Israeli leaders, military officials, and soldiers who are accused of carrying out crimes against Palestinians.
I doubt that that will make such a difference in Israel, because if we know the nature of Israel and it's based on violence, based on the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and grabbing the land of Palestine, because of that, I don't think that will make a big difference for the Israeli policies in the region.
The Palestinians have asked the court to look into Israeli crimes during its 2014 war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as Israel's construction of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The ICC's decision paves the way for the tribunal's prosecutor to open a war crime investigation. But the main question lingering in mind is that will the U.S., which has furiously condemned the court, allow prosecution of Israeli officials and forces over their crimes committed in the Palestinian territories? Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there is a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks.
The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population.
U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients through testing before entering Korea, and more thorough management measures should be implemented not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
The International Criminal Court has ruled that it has jurisdiction to examine possible Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a statement, the court announced that it has decided by majority that its territorial jurisdiction in the situation in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. the ICC's decision has been praised by Palestinians, with Prime Minister Mohammad Shatayeh calling it a victory for justice.
The resolution is a message to the perpetrators of crimes that their crimes will not be subject to statutes of limitations and that they will not go unpunished.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also called the ruling a historic day for the principle of accountability, and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged the court to investigate the Israeli crimes, describing its decision as a major development. Different international human rights organizations have also reacted, with Amnesty International calling the decision a long overdue step towards justice for victims. Human Rights Watch also described the ruling as a real hope for victims of serious crimes. Israel, which is not even a member of the ICC, decried the ruling, saying the court is a political body, not a judicial institution. As expected, the U.S. officially opposed the court's decision. Experts say the ruling is a game-changer for Tel Aviv and Washington.
Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, President Biden will face an interesting challenge. I expect that his reaction will be considerably different than Trump's.
The ruling came amid Palestine's call for further scrutiny into the 2014 Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, in which more than 2,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of children, were killed. 6 years ago, the office of the court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, began a preliminary investigation of Israeli actions in Gaza. In 2019, Bensouda announced that there was a reasonable basis for opening an investigation into the Gaza war and the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Ironically, Israel has continued its crimes against the Palestinians and its expansionist agenda, including illegal settlement activities with the tacit support of the United States and in defiance of UN resolutions. International rights groups have long raised the alarm about Israeli atrocities. Last year, the UN also said that Tel Aviv's excessive force against Palestinians holding weekly anti-occupation rallies may amount to war crimes. The latest ICC ruling has dealt a severe blow to Israel, but will the Palestinians get the justice for crimes they have endured for decades remains to be open.
There are many EU legislators who depict Russia as a dangerous adversary that needs to be restrained. They condemn the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the handling of protests in Russia.
The European Union needs to send a message by not only considering new sanctions, but also by increasing our support to prosecuted, tortured, and repressed voices of the opposition and the civil society.
It's rarely highlighted by mainstream media in the West that Navalny received a prison sentence last month after returning to Russia for breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. Also, Western media never mentioned the global pandemic when reporting on public protests in Russia organized by Navalny supporters. Just last weekend, 500 protesters were arrested here in Brussels, and those detained made claims of police brutality. Mainstream media vilify demonstrators here and in other Western nations for breaking COVID-19 rules, while at the same time portraying protesters in Russia as heroes. The EU and US accused the Russian government of poisoning Alexei Navalny last August. Navalny was treated in Germany after the alleged murder attempt. The Kremlin denies any role and is clearly unhappy that EU authorities refuse to provide medical evidence.
It is quite impolite, mildly speaking, and it is such arrogance from cultural Europe. It seems to me unacceptable and we categorically reject it.
There are many reasons why Brussels should try to improve relations with Moscow, some EU lawmakers insist.
Well, Russia is a capital neighbor. We cannot ignore that the longest neighbor, the longest border, it is with Russia. Russia is not only, an energy supplier. It's as well a strategic relation.
A good case in point, a number of EU nations are now scrambling to get their hands on Russia's Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, which is more than 90% efficacious. The EU has major vaccine supply issues. Moscow says it's happy to help. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months. But we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir, where tensions continue to increase. There is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Rights of the Children. Islam's general approach to children may be summarized in a few principles. The first one is, it is a divine injunction that no child may become the cause of harm to the parents. It has been mentioned in Surah Al-Baqarah, which is chapter number 2, verse number 233. Secondly, by implication, the parents should reciprocate and cause the child no harm either. The Quran recognizes very clearly that parents are not always immune from overprotectiveness or negligence. On the basis of this recognition, it has, number 3, established certain guidelines and pointed out certain facts with respect to children. It points out that children are joys of life as well as source of pride, seeds of vanity and false security, fountains of distress and temptation. But it hastens to stress the great joys of spirit and caution parents against overconfidence, false pride, or misdeeds that might be caused by children. So brothers and sisters out there listening to us, know that your children have rights upon your neck. These rights have to be fulfilled in the light of the divine teachings of Islam. You know, sometimes our society defines those rights. We're not talking about those rights because some of them may, you know, coincide or be in line with the instructions and guidelines of Islam, and sometimes they may not be. So we're not talking about your social responsibility.